From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at a new analysis of second offense marijuana possession arrests in Milwaukee County, a felony in Wisconsin.
We heard one story from a lawyer who told us that the officer scraped a few remnants off a car carpet so the person could get busted for second offense marijuana.
Then why the disappearance of small farms around the country should be of concern to people in both rural and urban America.
I'm really concerned about the countryside and rural communities because how is that ever going to transfer to the next generation? And that's a real question that I think we need to ask ourselves when we think longer term.
Plus, we'll have this week's editions of Radio Chipstone and our storytelling series, Ex Fabula.
Lake Effect Weekend comes your way next after this news update.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. An analysis of felony second offense marijuana possession in Milwaukee County has found a troubling pattern. Of the 95 stops where no other crime was being committed, 86% of the people arrested were African American.
The number is startling in a county where African Americans make up only 25% of the population. The Wisconsin Justice Initiative conducted the research, and Gretchen Schulte is its executive director. Schulte recently joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio and begins by explaining what prompted this analysis.
I think it was just because data is so hard to come by, and we just wanted to see what was going on. There has been an effort. The state public defender requested in its last budget request that second offense marijuana possession be reduced to a misdemeanor, and it didn't get included in the governor's budget. It has gone nowhere. And we started wondering who got arrested for second offense marijuana, which second offense possession of any amount is a felony in Wisconsin.
Any amount at all?
Any amount, from 0.01 ounces to, eventually it comes intent to distribute, but any amount. The most minute amount. We heard one story from a lawyer who told us that the officer scraped a few remnants off a car carpet so the person could get busted for second offense marijuana.
Who is getting arrested for these second offenses?
Black men with car problems north of I-94 in the city of Milwaukee.
Very specific.
Very specific. It's amazing how specific. We did a total for 2015 and 16, and these are cases where second offense marijuana possession is the only charge. We didn't want to litter the background with possession of a weapon charges, fleeing, bail jumping, and these are just second offense. So we got a total of 95 cases, 89% African American, 9% white, and 2% Hispanic in the city of Milwaukee. Of the 95 cases, 76 were in the city north of I-94.
How do those numbers compare with the makeup of the county in general and the areas where they were arrested?
Certainly where they were arrested were heavily African American. But in some cases like Wauwatosa, I remember this case very well. The complaint said a man who was African American was driving westbound on West North Avenue. So the officer ran his registration, and he had an outstanding municipal warrant or something like that. So you wonder what prompted this officer to run a person's registration just because they're driving westbound on North Avenue in Wauwatosa. To me, it kind of smells of driving while black. A lot of the stops were for car problems, non-functioning taillights, parked too far from the curb, tinted windows. One was, he was parked at a gas station, and yet he wasn't purchasing gas. How suspicious. Let's roll up and smell marijuana, which is another amazing impact. Milwaukee police have highly, highly trained noses because they are always smelling marijuana in these traffic stops, which leads to a search.
Yeah, so what do they need in order to search, just to be able to smell marijuana?
Yes. There are a few cases where there were consensual searches. One can argue when you're stopped by a cop and they're saying, hey, we want to look through your car, how much that consent that is. And Milwaukee police supposedly have stopped doing consensual searches. But they need very little. Smell of marijuana. I don't know. How much does 1/10 of an ounce of marijuana smell?
Yeah.
Milwaukee police can smell it.
So when you look at the rationale for why most of these black drivers specifically were stopped versus the white drivers who also had these felony offenses, what was there a difference or were they similar?
I think the real difference is that white drivers weren't stopped. I mean, that to me was the most significant thing. Are we saying that white people don't smoke marijuana? People south of I-94 don't smoke marijuana?
How do these numbers compare with what we know about marijuana smokers in the city of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County? I know there's not probably a lot of hard data, but what we kind of know.
Well, nationally, the rates of use of marijuana among blacks and among whites are pretty similar. There might be a few percentage points different, but it's not reflected in these numbers. I do believe that African-American drivers, because of the high poverty rates in those communities, are more likely to have minor things wrong with their cars. But I think in a lot of other communities in Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, you'll find that as well. But it's still the African-American drivers who are being arrested for second offense marijuana. I mean, I have genuine respect for John Chisholm, but charging these cases is just something I really disagree with him on. We don't need to make felons or create another felony for someone just because 10 years ago they had some other felony. The district attorney does say he doesn't like to make a person's first felony a possession of marijuana felony, but I'm wondering why because someone had a felony 5 or 6 or 7 or 2 years ago, having a joint is a felony today. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. So we were talking before the interview about kind of steps moving forward. And it seems like there's some, not pending legislation, but some talk of decriminalizing marijuana.
Yes. There was last session introduced in the legislature bills to decriminalize and to legalize cannabis. And they went nowhere. Republicans bottled them up in committee. So we believe, and fortunately John Weishon believes, County Supervisor John Weishon, that people should have a say on it. So he's introduced a resolution calling for an advisory referendum in November on marijuana legalization. With any luck, that will at least start a discussion and let people have a voice in the matter. The legislature obviously doesn't want people to have a voice in the matter, so we're turning to local officials for help and allowing people to speak on this issue.
Gretchen Schulte is executive director of the Wisconsin Justice Initiative. You can find out more about their recent report on second offense marijuana possession in Milwaukee at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, we examine the alarming state of small farming across the United States with contributor Dave Kozlowski. Like Fec Weekend continues right after this on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Small farms, whether family-owned or not, represented 46% of production in the United States in 1991. But by 2015, that share had fallen to under 25%, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Among dairy farms in Wisconsin, the numbers are especially striking. The state topped out at 167,000 dairy farms in 1940. Now, it just has 9,000.
While the average farm size grows, the total amount of land in farming has remained the same, and small farms are feeling the pinch as agribusiness dominates. Contributor Dave Kozlowski says this should concern not just farmers and rural residents, but everyone. He joined me, along with cattle farmer Kirsten Jersick and dairy farmer Sarah Lloyd, to talk about the alarming state of small farms and why they think things need to shift.
The trend has been big farming. Farms in this state and elsewhere are getting bigger. Small farms are dying. And this is true probably across the board, whether it's poultry, beef, pork, or vegetables for that matter. And the handmaiden, I think, to this process is technology. And there's a lot of gee whiz thinking when this technology comes out. And of course, it's expensive. And the only way you can manage incorporating that technology into your business is to get bigger.
And I think another part of that is what you might call the treadmill of production or the treadmill of technology that people get on, because my husband and I dairy farm with his family. We're three families in the operation. They expanded from 125 cows to 250 in like 2003, and that was to pay for a new milking parlor. And so once you take on that debt, because you don't want to wreck your knees and your body bending down under dairy cows all day long, you then have to like accelerate your production, and then you owe money to the bank, and then you sort of get on that treadmill. And we've had pretty bad markets in a lot of different commodities. Dairy is in a terrible situation right now, but beef has been in bad situations. Corn and soybean farmers are in bad situations. So everybody's kind of just trying to eke out a little bit more production just to keep their heads above water. So part of it is just the pricing and the markets are not supporting family scale agriculture right now. People can't be in business. It doesn't work.
Well, you mentioned that you're a three family farm, and a lot of farms, whether it's dairy, meat, or produce, are consolidating with each other to survive. And from what I understand, the need for people to do that is ever increasing because you need to be big enough so that you don't fail. Otherwise, you fall off the treadmill, right?
Yeah. And the other thing that I am concerned about is, you know, what are the bankers doing in this? I kind of really look to the credit industry because they're lending money to people to go well past our size, which is 350, to go to 1,000 and 5,000. Even though for dairy, we're in a terribly low price trough, and it doesn't make any sense to me, like from Econ 101, why it would make sense to, when you're losing money in every cow you're milking, how it would make sense to expand, but yet people are getting credit and financing to put these huge capital investments in. And then what happens to those, even if I'm three families, or maybe I'm four families? What happens in the next generation when I have $10 million in capital investment in this farm? I'm really concerned about the countryside and rural communities, because how is that ever going to transfer to the next generation? And that's a real question that I think we need to ask ourselves when we think longer term.
What we've seen is we're not reading our history. I mean, this is the same thing that happened in the late 70s and early 80s, which caused the so-called farm crisis of that time. The solutions weren't very good, and we're heading towards another farm crisis.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering was, you know, when were small farms in America last at a comfortable and profitable size and balance? Was there a peak, or has it always been a somewhat tumultuous business?
Probably the 40s, 40s and 50s, because then after the war, we started introducing all sorts of technologies that cost money, and to adopt them required farms to change their operation. So while there were still a lot of farms in the 40s, 50s, and 60s that were small and profitable, in part because the markets were there, and there was still a lot of direct marketing of product back then. But the writing was on the wall. It was already heading in that direction. What does Errol Butts from the 70s, Get Bigger, Get Out? It was already there.
I mean, it has definitely been a long slog historically. I mean, I even think about our friend Fighting Bob La Follette back in the early 1900s. And what was he fighting he was fighting like railroad monopolies that weren't allowing farmers to access markets and transport their products. And he was working to break that up. So we maybe kind of break it up and then it gets consolidated again. And now we're in this new phase of mega consolidation in all of the sectors of the supply chain, which again just isn't allowing farmers to have good, solid markets where they can predict. And then you've also added a lot of volatility in the prices because we aren't regulating that. We aren't really watching how much speculation is going on in the market. And farmers don't have control. They're just price takers for the most part, except for bright spots where people are trying to figure out markets, direct markets. I mean, Organic Valley has been a bright spot in Wisconsin, but it's struggling right now for farmers. But that was where they figured out a market. They could control it from the farmer up to the product, and they could find the consumers that were like, yeah, I'll pay a premium price because I want to support farmers, I want to support cows on grass, I want to support reduced pesticide use. And so you saw that, wow, like, look, we could do this. And Wisconsin has such a great opportunity. We still produce a lot of things in a small and medium scale. And I think now it's now or never really to save it.
Wouldn't it be nice if the farmers in Wisconsin could go down to the Chicago Board of Trade and say, this is what we're asking for our milk.
You know? Yeah.
We're not going to take your price. This is what we want.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I do think it's a timely issue because as a small family farm, once all the farms get bigger, our supply chains go away. So we're losing the supply chains that support our small to mid-sized farms as well.
Right.
So.
We've loss of meat processors, loss of the trucking that people want to pick up the milk or haul the beef. They don't want to go to you if you're too small.
So what I'm wondering is this capitalism or survival of the fittest in the farm world, or is this a result of USDA or government action or inaction that has caused this climate?
Well, I definitely feel that some of the rules that have changed in Wisconsin over the last few years have made it much easier for large confinement farms to be sited in Wisconsin. So I think that's a huge issue.
Drawing parallels on how Walmart impacted rural communities and shutting down small stores, family-owned operations, is big agribusiness the Walmart of the farming industry?
Yes. I'll say it. Yes. you know, and there's something that we're perhaps overlooking a little bit because we're talking about the economics of farming. And as we all know in economics, they, economists tend to not want to include externalities. One of the problems we're having as we get big is we're losing our sight on how land is treated and how the environment is treated. The other thing is the shadow that is beginning to be cast over all of us, and that's climate change. I just heard a report this morning that they're predicting California temperatures to go up even higher than they have been and to get drier. Now, California is number two in dairy and number one in a lot of produce. We lose California. Are we prepared? Do we have a resilient food system? Do we have a way of bouncing back from that loss of that chain?
Also, I feel like we haven't taken into the socioeconomic cost of our food production. So the issues we're having around the state of Wisconsin with our groundwater and our surface water contamination, and that flushes all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico and the dead zone in the Gulf going out to 25 miles now. So we're not taking those considerations into account at all when we're citing these farms. And it's a huge issue.
Farmers shouldn't be penalized for taking care of the environment. They should actually be paid for taking care of the environment.
Right. And one other aspect that's happening, especially here right outside of Milwaukee, is the buying of land for bigger industries such as Foxconn. So a lot of small farms are on the disappearing end because of industrial agriculture or commercial and residential expansion. So in a world where it's seen that a city's healthy if it is expanding outside of its borders and adding more houses, what is the case to remind people that, no, we need to keep a balance?
I like the word resiliency that you asked. You know, do we have a resilient agriculture? And I think when we think about cities and what their breadbasket is, we would do better. We would have stronger economy, better social relationships, and be thinking about the ecology of the situation if we really looked at kind of micro regions, but then the larger regions, and could really grow a lot of good things in a positive way if we thought about, you know, do we have some redundancy in the system? Like, I want more farms, not fewer farms. We need to really think about redesigning and reimagining the supply chains with a view towards transport, but just building community. I mean, I think that that's a bright spot in people realizing that they can come together around food. And we have really good food here and really great food culture. So that's, to me, like in all the doom and gloom, like let's really invest in that.
With developments like this, we also see it with the confinement farms. The confinement farms need a place to spread their waste, and so they can pay a lot more for the land than a beginning farmer. So as a farmer, you sort of get into this situation, do I keep farming for a very low margin, or do I just sell my land and be sad about it and move on?
Right. And, you know, you guys would know this better than I would, but the farmers that serve the CAFOs are on contract, right? So they're not necessarily connected to the price of corn or soybean or something that's on the market. They could get a higher price if they needed to.
Yeah, I think in different industries, like dairy versus pork versus, you know, crops, I think it differs to the extent people are on contracts. But that larger economy allows you to forward contract in ways that even at 350 cows, like my husband and I, we don't have enough milk to play that game. And if you go to a 5,000 cow dairy, if you spend more than a day there, you'll see these marketing contracted people coming in about how you should put and call. And, you know, so you're not really connected to the real price. And I also speculate that there are probably investment dollars going into large farms in Wisconsin that they don't even care if they're taking a loss, because they may be covering a gain in some other sector and for tax purposes are looking for a loss, which is really sad when you think about how hard farmers work every day to produce good food. And you have this whole other part of the production that doesn't really care what the price is.
Right. And again, even if they care, they only care about the bottom line. They don't care about those externalities that we were talking about before. That's so important to the citizens in this state.
On the note of certain people only caring about the bottom line, farmers have a multitude of their own concerns. Why should urban communities care about this in what is mostly seen as a rural issue, especially if people aren't familiar with where their food is coming from? Because people in a city can go to the store, it's there, they don't think about it.
Well, if they would like to go on vacation around the state and have clean waters to kayak in or canoe in, be able to go to a campground and pump the water out of the well and actually drink the water, be concerned about the health of our state, the health of our citizens, then they should be very concerned.
Yeah, I mean, small farms are more apt to keep wildlife habitat for insects and birds and other critters. People want those birds coming back to their bird feeders in the city. And if unless you have that habitat, they're not going to be coming back because they're not going to exist anymore.
One thing I was also thinking about is that American farming is also so romanticized by the public. You know, throughout time, whether people understand what goes into farming or not, you know, there's always this ideal that people think, no, there should be farms, there should be farmers. But is this romanticism a good or a bad thing when really there's a lack of understanding of what it means to operate a farm nowadays?
I hope that people are still romantic. I'm still romantic, and I shovel some poop everywhere. Yeah, but people should get it, because I think that the risk is that they look at some things that they don't understand and say, oh, all of that is bad. Because, you know, there are things that go on a farm every day that a person that's never experienced that might not understand and be concerned about. If you just think, you know, things are born on the farm every day, things die on the farm every day. It's a real cycle of life. And the more that we can get people coming out to farms, seeing farms, meeting farmers in the city, that would be a great thing to just continue to expand on so that they can understand what's going on in the background.
And Sarah, you mentioned earlier that if people and business operations can really decentralize and put that importance back into regional foods truly so that pricing, market value, all those things reflect that, is it the role of the government to do that, or is it the role of consumers to push for this? How do we begin that step?
Yes. Both. Both and.
It is. Because, I mean, who's the government, right? It's us. And this issue is really an urban issue, not a rural issue, because the city is our marketplace. And unless folks here get concerned about the environmental issues and, quite frankly, some of the health issues of the food that's being produced elsewhere, then nothing's really going to happen because the government's not going to act and markets aren't going to reflect any changes. So the people really need to take an interest in this. We need to get relearned about
local and knowing your farmer and
where
knowing
our
food comes from and how your food is actually raised. There's so many different labels out there that I can see where a consumer would get confused. Over the last 15 years, we went from a few labels on food to a multitude of them. So it's almost hard to navigate that whole labeling chain. But if you actually go out to the farms and meet the farmers and spend time with them and know how they farm, then you'll know how your food is raised and if it's raised in a manner that that's what you want to eat or not.
It's called transparency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really encourage people to be food citizens. So, you know, you're eating, you're making a political statement with your dollars when you're buying things, but you also have an obligation, whether you live in a city or a rural space, to make sure you're in touch with your state, your county that has a lot to do with land decisions, with your state, with the federal government, and make sure that they understand how important it is to you as a consumer, as an eater. And I encourage people to geek out in the grocery store and look at all the products. Like if you go in the dairy aisle in Wisconsin, look for the 55, which is the inkjet label, because that says that it was processed in Wisconsin. So there's a start. Start looking at your butter packages and your dairy cartons and start to understand where is that actually coming from? How did that get to the farm into my shopping cart and on my table?
And if these steps are taken overall and we do move towards a more regional and more diverse base for foods, will that positively impact the value of American agricultural products? Because as you mentioned, we rely heavily on California. Dave and I have talked about what comes in from overseas regarding products. So if our food system is shifted, will that, you know, ultimately help the bottom line that people are concerned about?
Yes. But people are going to have to be willing to pay more for food.
And that's the difficult part.
Mm-hmm. And people are going to have to be strategically political, both from a kind of big P politics and I call like small P politics. People need to push. We need to restructure the economy because right now, as we mentioned earlier, you have bigger and bigger players pulling more than their fair share of the piece of the pie. And that doesn't just happen, like to dismantle that is not just going to happen naturally. Like we're going to have to push, we're going to have to find the ways that we can do that. If from a Milwaukee perspective, really encouraging the people that are working on food system stuff, the grocery co-ops, I give a big shout out to Roundy's here, Milwaukee company now owned by Kroger, but they've been really active in getting fresh produce in from the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative, which is a cooperative I work with, and I really appreciate that they've been working with that co-op of now 40 farmers across the state for now 6 years to help build those supply chains.
Yep. And that's an excellent example on how we can build those supply chains by using, you know, a food hub like that.
Well, with all of your various experience of farming and agriculture, what is all of your call to action? If we go one by one, any closing thoughts on, you know, this big topic that we're trying to tackle?
If the people seem to still maintain this sort of Currier Ives and Norman Rockwell vision of agriculture in Wisconsin, it's going away. Unless they take an action, unless they take some interest in where their food comes from and demand some changes in agriculture that will provide a more local, regional system of food.
Know your farmer and know your politician.
Well, and as a dairy farmer right now, I have to just speak out about the real crisis that's going on. We're losing, I heard earlier was a one farm a day, but now I've heard it's 1.5 farms a day are going out of business, dairy farms in Wisconsin. And we have over 8,000 dairy farms, but even just maybe 15 years ago, we had 14,000 dairy farms. And when you think about the rural economy and just the land base and who's caring for the land, losing all those people on the land is a real problem. And so we need to demand federal action, like emergency action, to help farmers right now. But then we need to take the long game and rebuild the structures that will support families.
Well, Kirsten, Sarah, and David, thank you all so much for coming in to talk about this today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Sarah Lloyd is a local dairy farmer and the special projects coordinator for the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Kirsten Jurczyk is with the Bratzett Family Farm in Jefferson, Wisconsin, and Lake Effect contributor Dave Kozlowski co-owns Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek. You can find out more at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break, and then Radio Chipstone explores what's in a jug. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Glorianne Langva is a second-year grad student studying ceramics at UW-Madison. Her narrative work reflects her desire to create sculptures that tell a story. This semester, she decided to take a class in material culture that focused on Victorian ceramics. The class project was to curate a show entitled What's in a Jug?
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, contributor Jennifer Fields met Langva in the Object Study Room at the Chazen Museum. It's where the jugs live, and it's also the place Langva studies works of the past for inspiration.
I'm interested in the way that the Victorian aesthetic described narratives and folklore and stories that were passed down from generations through oral tradition. And there's definitely certain stories that stand out more to me than other ones, like in particular, like the Tam O'Shanter story. And on one side of the jug, it's depicting these men at the bar drinking too much and partying. And then the other side, they're being chased by witches. And so the inclusion of witches also sparks my interest because it's not only showing men behaving poorly, but it's also using this archetype of woman that's fearful, you know, and scary. And it's like trying to embed that idea in the culture that women have something to be feared, and that's something that's still kind of going on today.
But there's also another side to this story in Victorian age where it seems to me that when you look at what was happening, women were still in garments and in homes that seemed to repress them more than free them.
Yeah, and so that's another thing to kind of keep in mind when looking at these works, because a lot of these probably were used to decorate their home, the domestic space that, you know, women were chained to, and so it's these are the objects that they got to look at and hopefully were able to see themselves in these stories and be able to live in a fantasy outside of their kind of domestic prison.
When you look at all these beautiful jugs with all this ornate work, you have these beautiful blues and soft lavenders, there's a berry color, they're all, they have this grace and reverence. And then you look down here, and it's either a witch or Mother Hubbard, or Mother Goose. I'm not sure who this woman is on this jug, but.
Well, she's a sheep herder, I'm pretty sure.
You know who she looks like? This is terrible, but I'm gonna say it. It looks like the face of Lady Elaine from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, that scary little puppet.
Yeah.
That's what she looks like.
Yeah, she does. Oh, that's really funny. Yeah, so there became this huge tradition of making the pots people because there's this huge connection to the body and particularly the jug, you know, because there's the neck, there's the shoulders, there's the belly, there's the feet. And so at some point in this century, they decided to make jugs of people, like have the person be the jug instead of the jug displaying people.
So Gloria, as you stand here, has your work influenced how you look at these pieces, and have these pieces influenced what you produce now?
I think so. Yeah, I definitely think so. Not only did it give me ideas for different mythologies and what pop culture was like back then, but it also made me want to like include more detail in my work too. Because there's some of these jugs where like the fingernails on this man here are so defined, but the end of their faces aren't as defined. But seeing that makes me want to make the fingernails that defined. Because I do work in a small scale, and my figures are roughly that size, maybe a little bit bigger than that jug, but they're roughly that size. And so seeing how much time and effort someone put into something that long ago makes you keep wanting to do that.
Is there a particular story, a particular narrative you're chasing with your work?
Well, so I had my MA exhibition, and what I did for that show was I produced a body of work that was surrounded by one tale. And it was a story that I had came up after researching a number of different stories about strong archetypal women. And so this story is about this goddess who produces these women that live on Earth. And these women are magical and they have this power. And so they run this kind of cult, you could say, that protects the Earth. And it's kind of commenting on like the current culture and then also about, you know, giving strength to women, encouraging independent women to keep working and to keep striving for what they're looking for. I had a single mother growing up, and so she was always telling my sister and I, like, you have to go to school, you have to become educated, you have to get a job, and you have to be able to support yourself. You cannot rely on anyone else. You have to support yourself. Don't listen to people when they try to tell you you can't do something because you can. And so that's definitely something that was in my upbringing and something that resonates with me.
So what's the next story you're going to tell?
Well, most of my stories still kind of go along with this, like, you know, strong woman archetype. And so I want to keep expanding on this kind of magical, mythological aspect of this narrative that I created.
It's really interesting because there's that idea of talking about strong women and talking about strong women in reference and looking at something that appears to be so fragile.
Yeah, it is interesting. Yeah, and that's something I like about ceramics, is that there's these assumptions along with the material. Like, it can break. We all know that ceramics can break. And so there's this preciousness that becomes embedded in the object because of that. And that's something that I like to accentuate and hope that people realize when they do look at the work.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Fields spoke with UW-Madison graduate student Glorianne Langva.
One last break, then the latest episode of Exfabula, when Lake Effect Weekend returns on WUWM.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Exfabula!
True personal stories.
Exfabula!
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And that means it's time for another edition of Exfabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Rachel Owens, joined again by Exfabula co-founder Leah Delaney.
Here I am.
Back.
Hi, how's it going?
Going well. Have enjoyed some summer weather
yes.
This week. Oh, felt so good.
I know. Don't you feel like you're back in your element? Like, it's like somebody just took a light switch and just went click, and then, okay, we're all back.
Yeah, everybody's got the smiles on their faces.
People are driving real crazy. It's awesome. So many awesome things are going on with this weather, including the May All-Stars event. So we've been living under a rock these past few weeks. Exfabula Radio has been featuring all of Season 9's audience favorites from our season story slams. And we are putting them up on stage on Friday, May 18th at Turner Hall Ballroom for our Grand Slam All-Stars finale. So it's going to be good. These are the All Pros from season 9 coming up. And they're going to be telling a different story, a little bit longer form, up to 10 minutes, because usually it's 5 minutes that we give people up on stage. And the theme this time is going to be connections. Mm. It's a really great theme.
Definitely.
Yes, yes. So right now, we actually had 2 story slams in March. We took 1 month off to do a spectacular and a curated slam earlier this year. So our first slam that we had in March was the theme of karma, and the second one was TMI. So we have 2 winners from there. Let's listen. First one, Karma Slam in March. Here is Barbara Lee.
Karma is an incredibly wondrous thing, very mysterious. 20 years with my partner Robert was truly cosmic. I mean, we were so different, and yet we really fit together. And he was a great storyteller. And Robert had incredible karma. He escaped death at least 10 times, and sometimes in very spectacular fashion. But the last time, the 11th time, when they wanted to do one more procedure, and he was like, you know, my heart's failing, my kidney's failing, I'm in pain. No, no, I'm done. I'm going into hospice. And he died September 10th, very calmly, very peacefully, and pain-free. And then I was alone. And I was like, I don't know if I was in denial or what, but I realized that I hadn't really thought about how I was going to manage to stay in my apartment without him in terms of the rent. So I started trying to find a roommate. I put in notices at MSOE, MATC, UWM. It was October 1st. And I wasn't really sure how I was going to manage this. Well, I was going to go out. And I got a call from the management office. Barbara, are you still interested in a roommate? Oh, yes. Well, there may be somebody here who would also be interested. Why don't you come on down and meet her? Oh, yes. So I came down, and I met this very lovely, very young, 22 or 23-year-old with her parents. And she explained she's from Slinger. She'd just gotten this great job in Milwaukee. And she was so excited because she was supposed to move into a townhouse that very day. And she'd already put in her deposit. But her roommate had called her the night before and said, oh, I'm so sorry, but I just realized I added up all the money that it would cost me, and I was realizing I just can't move in with you next week. Really? She was pretty hysterical. She didn't know what to do. I said, well, you can come on up and take a look at the apartment. So she and her parents came up. They looked at the bedroom, and I was like, yeah, this is bigger than the one in the townhouse. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, you could have it furnished or unfurnished, and you can keep the big screen TV. Oh, and I'd have my own bathroom? Well, yeah. And how much does it cost? Well, that's a little less than the townhouse. I really started to like this person. She was really practical. She was asking all the right questions. I said, well, what do you think? She said, well, I really have to think about it. I'll call you tomorrow and let you know. So she called me the next day, and she said, well, there are 4 things that I really need. I need to make sure that it's clean, it's neat, and it's safe. So I want us to make sure to lock the door. I want to make sure that we clean up after ourselves, that it's tidy. And I want to make sure that, you know, I can have some space in the kitchen for all my things. Like, I like this person. She's really practical. So, yeah. And then she said, well, I also want to bring my piano, because I play the piano. And I'm like, a piano? Wow, she plays the piano, and I love piano. I'm like, I think this could work. She's like, well, yeah. She took a moment. I think so, too. And she moved in 2 days later, and it has been fabulous. She likes my stories. She also helps me with my computer glitches, of course. I show her banana pancakes with fried bananas. It's really something else. And then, you know, she plays piano beautifully. Mozart, Chopin, all the good ones. And then we do kickboxing together. I tell you. I still miss Robert terribly, but I'm not lonely. My friends say it's Robert still looking after me. I don't know what it is, but I'm really thankful for the mysteries and wonderfulness of karma. Who knew?
And that was Barbara Lee. She was the audience favorite for the first Story Slam that we had in March, where the theme was karma.
That was such a nice story. And when you think of how wrong roommate situations can go, it's so great to hear the opposite story where something goes so right.
Yes, which rarely happens. Yeah. You know, you always remember the bad ones.
Yeah. I also wish that karma could transfer like that, because I'd like to, you know, inherit some other people's good karma as well.
Yeah, that's so true. So we have some other events coming up. One on Wednesday, May 9th, next week. The fellowship event is themed Media and Representation, which is going to be held at 88.9. This is going to be a really interesting event. It's going to talk about media and who's represented, who is not being represented. And then on Tuesday, May 22nd, we have a volunteer orientation. So all of those who want to be cool and want to get hip to helping the community out and feel good in turn can definitely come to that. And of course, on Friday, May 18th, we have our All-Stars. The theme is connection. And let's just move right into our second story. This was from the second Story Slam that we had in March. The theme was TMI, and as you can imagine, it was a rowdy night.
Too much information.
Yeah. So the audience favorite from that night was Young Kim. So it's bleeperific, but an awesome story, and here's why. Let's listen.
I know some of you are wondering, what flavor is he? I'm Korean. My parents came over here from Korea in the 1950s as graduate students. They met here, and then they had me. I was born in Alabama, Tuscaloosa, grew up in Louisiana and North Carolina. I like to tell people that I am South Korean. But growing up in the South as an Asian was kind of a I remember my first day of kindergarten. I got to the school and I'm milling around and some older kids got around me and I guess they had not seen an Asian before. They wanted to know what I was. They wanted to know my name. I told them Young Kim, and Young Kim is like Joe Smith in Korea, but this is New Orleans. And one of the kids says, Kim, that's a girl's last name. So I went back home to tell my parents and they told me, well, next time that happens, just tell them that you're an American citizen. And my knowledge of playground justice when I was five told me that line of reasoning, no matter how reasonable or logical, was not going to fly. So I knew they would be of no help, so I decided I would never bring it up to them again. And so I decided I would just try to fit in. But fitting in is hard when your parents speak the language with an accent. Korea does not have what they call definite or indefinite objects, the, a, or an. So when you have a language that where you have to say the cat or a house, you know, it gets kind of confusing. So one day my dad's driving me and of some high school friends somewhere, and he decided to have a conversation with us about drugs. And he goes, so, do you know anyone who smokes the pot? After college, though, I worked for a company that sent me to Korea, and I was ecstatic. And I go through customs at the Kimpo Airport in Seoul, and they tell me the customs agent sees my U.S. passport, sees my name. Oh, Young Kim, you are Korean. And I just nodded, but inside I was going, yes, Young Kim, prodigal son, has returned to the land of his ancestry. And then he started shooting questions in Korean at me. And I said, whoa, English, please. And as he stamps my passport, hands it to me with a frown, he says, then you are not Korean. The rest of the trip went downhill. Every Korean businessman I saw, they saw young Kim. They assumed I could speak Korean, and I would say English only. I'd give them the rigmarole about growing up in the South. And came to a head, I guess, on day four. We went to a Korean restaurant. You know, I'd had 4 days of Korean food. I love Korean food, but not for 4 days. And my system started to go, okay, purge. So I went to the bathroom. And I go to the bathroom, and it's a Korean squat toilet. And I knew I was because, you know, up here, this part looks Korean, but everything below is Western. I cannot squat and without getting poop on my shoes, on my ankles. That was my first real encounter with the Kubler-Ross five stages of grief. The five stages of grief are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. We have to go through that to get over anything. Sometimes those stages take a lifetime, sometimes it takes a year, sometimes it takes a month, but in my case, I had 30 seconds because I had 2 inches of sphincter muscle holding back 30 years of identity crisis angst about to come flying out my anus. So, denial. I walk in. Oh, no, 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 no. There is not a sit-down toilet here. Anger. These Koreans. Bargaining. Okay, maybe I can just lie down and hang my over the thingy. Depression was, I thought I was Korean. And then finally I came to acceptance. That was my Kubler-Ross experience. I hope you pick up on the TMI theme. I came home and I realized that America is where I belong. America is home. Milwaukee, the most American of cities, is my home. I belong here. Thank you.
And that was young Kim's story. He was the audience favorite from our second story slam in March.
I love how he broke that down to the different levels of grief. And
yes.
That was so appropriate. And you only had 30 seconds to make that happen.
That was a great night. And I got to tell you, Garfield's 502 is an awesome place. They have great food. And we just packed the house that night. Actually, we packed both of those nights. We sold out for both of those events. Yeah, speaking of, we have a All-Stars event coming up. We would love to sell that night out at Turner Hall Ballroom on May 18th. We also have a couple of fellowship events coming up. All story information and more can be found at xfabula.org.
Well, until then, glad that we had these stories to hear today, and look forward to having you back next week.
I'll be here.
Okay, thanks, Leah.
X-Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and that wraps up the show for today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, and be sure to tune into our weekday version of the show at 10.
It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now. All Things Considered comes your way next. It's 4 o'clock.